Are you also tired of one-size-fits-all weight loss plans? Meet Noom, the personalized solution that meets you where you are. Noom is able to understand your unique needs, from dietary restrictions to medical concerns. Unlike restrictive programs, Noom embraces your lifestyle and choices. Discover a sustainable approach to weight loss, tailored just for you. Honestly, Noom felt like it was made for me. It's not just about what I eat. It's about understanding why. With Noom, I've learned so much about myself and built healthier habits that stick. It's all about progress, not perfection. Say goodbye to restrictive diets and experience the Noom app for yourself with personalized lessons and expert coaching. Noom's psychology and biology-based approach has helped over 5.2 million people achieve their goals. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Well, heidely ho, neighborinos. It's your old friend Stephen Schleicher. And I know what you're thinking. Stephen, is it really time for another episode of Critical Hit? And the answer, of course, is yes. Yes, it is. We're so happy to be here with you each and every time to share thoughts, ideas, fun around the game table, and so much more. I bet I know what else you're thinking. Steven, you just finished Panic at the Dojo. Is it time for Drifters? Not quite. And I'll say more about that in just a moment. Instead, what I wanted to do this week was I wanted to share with you another episode of the GM Roundtable. Now, for those of you who are not aware, the GM Roundtable is a monthly panel, live panel, where members from Critical Hit and other places come on to give you tips on how to be a better GM at the table, not only for your own well-being, but for the fun and enjoyment of everyone at the table with you. Now, this runs monthly. We cover a variety of topics ranging from world building to creating effective villains to talking about technology and so much more. So what I wanted to do this month was I wanted to release an old episode of the GM Roundtable so you can get a taste, a little bite of what awaits you when you become a patron over at patreon.com/majorspoilers at the silver level and higher. When you become a patron at the silver level and higher at patreon.com/majorspoilers, you get access to Critical Hit a week early. You get access to the GM Roundtable, which is live. And it's really a fun event when it's done live because so many people are able to raise their hand and ask questions. Discord now uses stages, which in this episode that you're listening to, it's before we started using stages. But you can come in and raise your hand and ask your questions live and hear those responses. And it's a great way to engage with everyone at Critical Hit and for us to engage with you. So you get access to that and a whole bunch more when you sign up for that silver level membership and higher. Now, the silver level membership, I think, is a great option and a great deal. It's only $5 per month. $5 per month, that's like paying a buck. Essentially a buck an episode for every episode of Critical Hit that we have. Plus you get access to all of that extra stuff. So if you would, as you're listening to the GM Roundtable this week as part of Critical Hit, head over to patreon.com/majorspoilers and sign up for that silver level membership. It would be a great thing to keep us going, to keep the GM Roundtable going, because we did kind of slip a little bit before our below our funding level this last month. But we want to make sure that the GM Roundtable continues. I would appreciate it, and everyone at Major Spoilers would appreciate it, because the money that you give doesn't go into some greedy owner's pocket where he's driving around in his Maserati with models and doing drugs and whatever else that all those high-end CEOs do. We take your money and we roll it right back into everything we do at Major Spoilers, including Critical Hit. Now, I told you I was going to put a little asterisk. We're going to come back to Drifters. What's going on with Drifters? Well, if you guys didn't know, if you don't follow us on Twitter, if you're not part of our Discord, which you really should become part of our Discord, it's totally free. And if you are a patron, you get to access other channels on our Discord server. You get new colors and some other features that you get to do when you join our Discord server as a patron. But months ago, couple of months ago when we went on hiatus from Drifters, Sam and Kevin's basement, and I think maybe some other parts of their house, got flooded from a storm that blew through their area. And so they were busy trying to clean up the mess, get their lives back in order, dealing with insurance. Many of you know, a couple of years ago, I went through the exact same thing with my basement, and it took a year before we were able to really get the basement back into a position where we felt like it was good again. So I understand completely what Sam and Kevin were going through. And so we took that break so that they could have the time to get all of that stuff back in order. And so I appreciate everyone who sat through this and listened to us take some breaks. I hope you enjoyed, you know, the Dusk City Outlaws and Panic at the Dojo. Thanks to Dr. Bradley Will for running Dusk City Outlaws for us. I really appreciate that. And also for participating and playing in our Panic at the Dojo game. I think he had a lot of fun with that, and hopefully you did as well. So the good news is Drifters comes back next week. We've already got a couple of episodes already in the can. Hopefully we can continue that and won't have an immediate break anytime soon. But be aware that we don't have as much stuff planned ahead like we used to. We used to have sometimes 6 months of shows already prepared and waiting to go. But because of how life gets in the way, sometimes we have to make some last minute changes. And so this is part of those last minute changes to ensure that we can build up enough episodes of Drifters before something else happens in this crazy world in which we live in. So thank you so much, everybody, for being patient. Thank you to all of our patrons who are making this show possible. And if you are a patron at the silver level, member and higher, patreon.com/majorspoilers, you can listen to Drifters, the new episode, right now. And you've got an exclusive RSS feed that you can subscribe to, too, so that you can get that new episode as soon as it's available. So what are you waiting for? Patreon.com/majorspoilers. Now, here is an episode of the GM Roundtable. Check it out. It's a lot of fun. And I don't say that just because I produce this show. I actually find it fun. Welcome to the GM Roundtable, your monthly roundtable discussion show where we help you become a better game master at the table for your own growth, and more importantly, so your players have fun. Thank you to everyone who's joining us live in the Major Spoilers Discord tonight. If you want to find out how you can participate and have your questions answered, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/majorspoilers. Players need a place to play and a world to explore, but how big do you make your world? Should it be an area that is only limited to what the players and characters see? Or do you need to go bigger? Do you need to go deeper? That's the topic we are discussing in this episode of the GM Roundtable. I am Stephen Schleicher. Thank you, everyone, for joining us this week. And we have some returning voices this week. We have D&D Brian.
Hello.
We have Rob.
Hi.
Samantha is joining us once again.
Hello.
Rodrigo is here.
Hey.
And this month we have special guest Dr. Bradley Will, who you may have heard on our Call of Cthulhu game, as well as some others. And if you are a patron, you're able to hear the Shadow of the Demon Lord that is up there right now. And it's a very exciting game. People like that one. Brad, welcome to the table.
Well, thanks for having me.
Not a problem. I think there was a comment that Christopher made that I think really kind of gives us an idea of where we want to go this month. He says, I'm working on a new setting this past week. Chinese Romance of the Three Kingdoms meets Stephen King's Gunslinger with a high fantasy approach. I'm looking forward to hearing the GM Roundtable as I flesh out this idea. And he didn't say what game system he is using. But I would imagine, Rodrigo, that game mechanics and the game system that you're playing factors a great deal into your world building.
It should. It really should, because you can see this even in professional role-playing games, game settings, where especially if a setting is being adapted and it doesn't really jive with the rules, it leads to kind of problem moments. If you instead, as you're creating your setting, you look at the magic system that the game already has, the conflict resolution system that the game already has, and you incorporate that, I guess they're having some trouble hearing me in the chat. You incorporate all that into the how the game into the setting, and as you think about the setting, it will help you a lot more. Like just a tiny example from Critical Hit is elves get a bonus, or they grant other people a bonus to spot, basically to spotting and listening. And that's something that, like, the game doesn't even explain. It's just kind of there. It's just like a bonus that they grant. So in Critical Hit, kind of came up with the idea that elves are very intense and they make everybody nervous all the time. And that's why everybody's senses are kind of heightened when elves are around. Because I think it even applies to, like, non-elves. So, like, other elves don't mind, but non-elves get freaked out by this. So that's just, like, one little bit where there's this thing in the rules that helps us to create essentially something that is now relevant and important in the setting.
All right. Very good. What about you, Brad? What do you think about mechanics and how they factor into the world?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to say Rodrigo's wrong, because Rodrigo's absolutely not wrong. I mean, okay, but here's the thing. So you've got a fate system, or you've got something like Spectaculars, that new superhero system, where the world building is done by the players at the table, or at least parts of it, right? Which is fascinating for me, because that implies that the world building is kind of, I mean, could be completely arbitrary in certain ways, right? So how does that... I mean, like, how do you guys account for the fate system, where you can kind of go in with a blank slate, or at least a pretty blank slate, maybe a plot, right?
But yeah, you do kind of have to have an idea of, like, what the system is like, at least what kind of tone it tends to best play as. So yeah, if you're going to go into fate winning like a grim, gritty, perilous game, that's not going to work too well. It really kind of works better for, like, high action, quick cinematic kind of play. So yeah, you can definitely, if you're doing this collaborative world building, run into such issues where, like, you want some sort of element. Like, I haven't looked at Spectaculars at all, but if you're wanting, like, a council of these superpowered beings who, you know, you're trying to represent certain powers, and that's just not something that's in the mechanics, that could be an issue, or that could just be, well, now that's just a GMPC. And
well, one of the Spectaculars things that they do is you decide in your first session, is this the kind of world where superheroes die a lot, or do they die occasionally, or do they die almost never at all? And then, based on that decision, the death mechanic changes.
Nice.
Yeah. So something like Fate, where everything's very loose anyway in the within the rules, it doesn't matter where people go, as long as the game still accounts for basically Fate's four mechanics, and usually it will. You're fine. And yeah, other systems like Cortex and like this one that you were mentioning will often say, well, if this is the tone that you're going for, then use these rules. So very often the system will take that into account. You can run into trouble if you're running a 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons game and somebody does say, like, ah, well, I want my character to come from a superhero planet. And then you're in trouble.
Yeah. Sam, do you have some thoughts on this? You or Rob have some thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the main things is basically your conflict resolution things. And also, like, you know, if you want a game that's going to be high on intrigue and influence and, like, controlling things around this behind the scenes, then, like, you know, you're probably not going to be playing D&D unless you're using some, like, very specific subsystems. Or if you are, like, you know, maybe you're kind of, like fudging some things, basically letting people use their social abilities to do things. But you'd be much better off playing in a game like a White Wolf game that actually has, like, influence and backgrounds and things like that. So, you know, really it's going to come down to the world and the systems don't... you don't want them to be at odds with each other. And likewise, as you guys have said, if it's going to be a game where you're succeeding more than you're failing, you know, that's going to have a tone on the world. It's going to cause more a heroic, pulpy feel, as opposed to, like, a dark, gritty feel that you can get. So you should just be aware of that.
All right. Why don't we go ahead into another question? Obviously, think about the game that you're playing into. And we had a bonus episode that we recorded last month where Rodrigo was talking about understanding what the game wants you to do. So maybe that's part of this discussion as well. Figure out what the game wants you to do and then craft your world in that way. Which then brings us to this thought, Rob. How far into building your story do you need to start building the world itself?
However far you want. Usually, if you're already building the story, you have started world building without knowing, or without, not necessarily without knowing it, but without intending to be building part of the world. The story is going to, or the world's going to come from the story anyways. So you don't need to necessarily wait to start building the world. Just once the world starts appearing because of your story, you can start tacking things onto that. Or if you come from the opposite side of the approach, you can have a world already, start building your world, and then put the story into said world. So there's no real, how long do I wait till I start doing this? Well, what's working best for you?
Yeah, and I guess that kind of depends on how big your campaign wants to be, yeah. Right? Because, for example, if you're just setting up a simple game where you're in a village, I think this is the one. This is how I built the game. The first time that I DM'd on the show was, here's this community or this area that's been plagued by dragons, and so everyone has come into this community, and so there's, you know, a mixture of different people, right? That was the basis for that. There's a big dragon, but then just outside of the city is this creepy old mansion where things are going to happen. Other than that, that is the extent of that world, right? So you yes. could have something that's very small like that, or you could be super big like Rodrigo and have something start out, well, we're in this portion of the world, and then as the game progresses, we'll move to this portion of the world, and then the Astral Sea, and then the Feywild, and then Southern Continent, and all these different kinds of things. So I guess that, you know, the size of your game or the story that you want to tell will kind of determine how big your setting needs to be and what kind of things you need to think about. And then that brings us into that, to this idea of, well, how do you build your world? Do you build your world from the micro, from very small things, as Rob was saying, you know, from the instant that you create it, your world building, do you build it from the micro to the macro, or do you go from everything in the world down to the micro? You know, do you look at it from the big perspective and then dive down? And Brad, you know, you have worked on editing Star Wars games in the past. Yep. And I know that, you know, going to different planets is kind of a big deal. You got your desert planet and you got your forest planet and your frozen planet, maybe a water planet and a city planet here and there. Do you know how they approach, you know, in the Star Wars universe, especially with the RPGs, how they approach that world building? Do they go, oh, we need to come up with a cool name and what it does, and then dive down into the little nitty gritty, or does it go the opposite way?
Well, it's not a cool name, but probably a cool planet concept. So the planet that I had the good fortune to actually get to name, didn't definitely start out with that name. But it's from the Galaxy of Intrigue book, and you can see what happens in that. So they build the project. We're going to have a book that's all about spies and intrigue. And so somebody build us a planet that's all about spies and intrigue. And so the planet is built around the theme for that book. I mean, that's, And it's, in that case, well, and there was one environment that was the stormy planet, which was why the name of the planet, I think, was originally Storm. If you look in that book and see the original graphics of the planet, the word Storm is there for the planet name. But we decided that was a little too on the nose, and so we had to change that. But so, yeah.
To Weather Planet.
Weather Planet is what we changed it to. No. But that's a call out for a book, right? Which is a very different thing than a DM or GM saying, I need a resource for my game. So that's a really weirdly Star Wars trope that the planet has one environment and you've got a, but here's the thing. But if you're playing a Star Wars game and you have a planet that has like really varied environments, your players are going to be totally thrown by that, right? Because they're pretty sure that there's one environment on every planet, because that's how Star Wars works. Because you've got to, because if you're gonna play in that shared world that your players already know, then you have to be in that shared world or don't, right?
Mm-hmm. Brian, do you have some thoughts on macro versus micro?
I definitely feel like it's, at least for me, a lot easier to start smaller, focused on, you know, small regions, you know, like you mentioned, a village or, you know, the adventure site of wherever the adventures are going, and just kind of build out and around from there. I do feel like having a framework, having at least a general idea of like what the world is like or to what the trajectory you want the campaign to follow is a good idea. I kind of think what I'm going to try to start doing is myself is kind of just picking two branching options when it comes to building worlds that where I think the players might go, instead of trying to come up with all the possible options and fleshing those out.
So explain that a little bit more. Give us an example.
Well, basically, if they're going to be traveling on from this small village where they, you know, cleared out some rats and going on to the next big thing, I would probably pick two, you know, fairly bigger events that are going to be happening nearby and flesh out those situations, you know, inciting incident.
Don't worry about the palace of the kingdom, right? Yeah. Worry about what's in the local and then build out that way. Okay. And
basically, giving them, like, you know, having those things that are more fleshed out so, you know, they can readily go those. And if they go somewhere else, I mean, you can probably mix and match what you've already made and freewheel it from there from what you've already prepared.
Rodrigo, how do you approach it? Because you have built a massive world in the world of Critical Hit. How do you go about building that world?
I actually do both. It's not like I, like the world of Critical Hit is always anywhere from a mile to, or like, I don't know, 10 miles to a block away from where we actually are in the story, right? It's like when we started playing, there was no such thing as the Sage Coast.
Right.
But eventually there was a Sage Coast in that same continent that I had kind of already drawn, you know? So you can kind of add stuff as you go. But for me, it will be something like I'll draw a map and I'll be like, here's the map. So here's this very macro look at how, what this continent looks like and where its mountains and rivers and stuff are. And then I'll be like, well, I really want to have like this like very rude person who's like maybe some sort of turtle. So I guess there's turtle people in this world now, you know, or some sort of like magical turtle type person. Mm-hmm. So now there exists some sort of cosmic reason for this thing to exist. So I do it both ways. And the important thing is to be conscious of your game's themes and your the sort of feel that you want the setting to have, so that you don't accidentally fight yourself on things, right? If your game is very like, haha, adventures, and you introduce this like very like gritty, like murderous, like amoral, like cult that is just doing like really actually terrible things, it might clash with what your players have been expecting or have been experiencing. So it's important to kind of keep that in mind. And then you can go either way. You can create a little village or you can create an entire country. And it's roughly the same process.
Sam, I got a question for you. Rodrigo had mentioned drawing maps. Excuse me. Are you someone that starts out with your world building by drawing a map and saying, well, here's where this part is and here's where this region is? Or how do you approach your world building?
Yeah, I love maps because geography is in some ways destiny. I mean, they're just like natural rules. And if your game is going to be one of those games, like if you're, you know, normally you have deserts near mountains and like, you know, certain plants grow near oceans. And if that's not going to be the case in your world, then like, that's kind of a thing. So if you want to be, have a, you know, a special island that's right off the coast of like a desert, but is like super tropical and beautiful all the time, it's like, well, maybe that's because they're stealing good weather from the desert, and that's its own plot. So, you know, it can depend. Even if it's just your, the scope of your game is really something to keep in mind if you do want to just, you know, doing like a one shot or a three shot or a limited run where it's really going to happen over a few locations. Mm-hmm. You know, what you need to know is where your central town is, what's around it, what the travel times are. And even so, it's still useful to have a map. But if it's going to be a, you know, a real big high fantasy game where you're going to have people coming from around the world and, you know, trade is a consideration and war is a consideration, then yeah, a big old map and kind of knowing in advance who's out there, what they're up to and what they're good at and, you know, why that is the way it is a really strong way to start.
So, yeah, that sounds like a really great way to start. But then where do you find inspiration for your game worlds and what you add to the game world? And I guess that then ties into how much research do you have to do. Rodrigo, where do you find inspiration?
Well, I definitely try to find my inspiration outside of role-playing games. Because it's pretty easy for us to just kind of be like, you know, most people are out there playing Dungeons and Dragons, so it's easy to just look at your Forgotten Realms and your Eberron and your I don't know, Dark Sun stuff and draw inspiration from there. But you can get a lot of inspiration from other places, and then to your players, if they're doing the same thing, it will seem fresher and you can get ideas from other places. Again, just it's important to remember A, your game's mechanics, and B, your themes, to see if that makes sense. But I mean, I've literally gotten inspiration from going to the zoo.
Oh, yeah.
From like walking into like a government building and seeing like the tile patterns. And I'm like, this is something, you know, I can do something with this.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely media, right? Movies, TV, music, you can get a lot of inspiration from other places. And as long as you're keeping your game in the back of your head at all times, you will get a lot of mileage out of other media.
Brad, what about you? Where do you find inspiration for building worlds?
Well,
especially Shadow of the Demon Lord, you know, you have some regions that you built up in that. I mean, that was already pre-planned in the game.
So Shadow of the Demon Lord, and this is part of the weird exercise that I occasionally do when doing creative stuff. So I'll set some weird rules for myself. Shadow of the Demon Lord is weirdly 100% pure stock. So there is nothing in there apart from some minor details that doesn't actually appear in official source material.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just a weird structure that I had kind of laid into myself. Can I actually create a whole campaign that has actual stock stuff that people who know the source material would absolutely know? I dug deep into that game and just stole everything.
Okay. But what about other games?
Well, other games though, yeah, you've got to go wherever. Like, when we did the Call of Cthulhu game, I knew it was going to be Hollywood and I knew it was going to be 1920s. And so again, I just immersed myself in one thing totally and just steal it all, right? So
yeah.
every possible location that I could pull in from 1920s Hollywood or any kind of Hollywood references I threw in that game.
Well, that does bring up a good question about what do you do if you're world building in the real world? And then that also kind of leads into like how much research do you have to do? So yeah. For example, just in general storytelling stuff, if I wrote a story that's set in, and Brad's read it, and I think a couple of other people have read it as well, set in 1918 in San Francisco. And it's like, okay, what are all the things that I need to draw from? And so I ended up having to spend a lot of time going, okay, what are some actual events that were happening in the city? Does that affect my story? I dove so far down into opening up a phone book from 1919 and flipping through the phone book to find out, okay, what kind of restaurants were there and does that fit into my story? And, you know, I knew one big part of the story needed to take place at a ranch north of San Francisco. And so I was like, oh, the first thing that comes to mind is Skywalker Ranch. And so that whole ranch that they go and visit at the beginning of the story is all based on Skywalker Ranch and this big sprawling, you know, ranch house that you see in the Victorian style.
Yeah.
That comes from that. So there's a lot of, you know, it depends. I think honestly, if you're setting something in the real world and you're trying to make it believable, I think you need to actually do even more research. And again, it depends on what, you know, what people are going to do in your world. If you're, for example, if you're setting it in the 1980s, like let's say your game takes place in 1982 and you're going to allow people to turn on a radio in your world and you're playing songs from 1985, then that kind of makes that world fall apart. Oh, you've got some inconsistencies there. So I think you need to do as much research as possible. You don't think so, Brian?
Well, I mean, it just kind of depends on the buy-in from your players, their willingness to forgive such inconsistencies. And I mean, if they are gonna, you know, basically know, you know, oh no, that song's from 1985, then yeah, I think you do need to do some research.
Right.
Yeah, real world can be definitely tough for that reason. And I don't know. I like to take, you know, liberal approach to, like, you know, I did Haze a game here, and there was definitely a lot of liberties taken with that game. And it's like, yeah, that's just the way it's going to be, because, you know, we need to be able to actually do stuff around here. But
Rob, you also don't think that doing a whole bunch of research is necessary for real world stuff.
Yeah, and part of it depends on, so like Brian said, if your players are going to really be nitpicky about it, you probably want to do a lot of research. But also, like, it depends on the level of investment your players or your audience is going to have in the setting, the whatever time period area that you're going for. And also for certain things, it's, you know, yeah, you may have flubbed up this this song didn't come out till 1985 and it's 1982. Well, this isn't our reality. Guess what? The song came out earlier.
Maybe it came through a weird rift in time.
That's part of
BioShock
your story.
Infinite.
So then I guess then, Rob, you're talking about your players. How do you integrate, or is it important, and maybe Sam, you can add on to this too, is it important to integrate your characters' backstories into the world, or do you ignore that completely and make the players' characters' backstories fit your environment?
It can be important. Part of that's going to depend on the player. Some players are going to be very disappointed if you don't take their 1,500-page backstory and put some amount of it into your world. But you don't always have to take everything that they give you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You can kind of piecemeal pick and choose, or Rodrigo's very, very good about this and kind of going back and forth with, well, this stuff works, this really doesn't work with what's going on, but this will work, and if we tweak this, we can get things going into the backstory. But sometimes you can just, you know, oh, well, you grew up in such and such region, we're playing over here, I'm not going to do anything with your backstory unless we decide that a character from your past is going to come up for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
what about you, Brad? Do you try to integrate character backstories into world building?
Well, I have, but I think with a great deal of failure. I think that my intention has been there, and then it doesn't, because I'll veer off to the left somewhere or something like that. And then, I'm probably a really bad person to ask about that, because I don't think I'm very successful at that. I mean, it's something I'm consciously frustrated by.
Sam, what about you? When you do you work with your players to design the places that they've come from? You know, if your character comes from the dirty swamps, do you talk with them and help build up that dirty swamp region and with you know, histories and politics and all of that stuff?
Yeah, I think it's really valuable to do that. You know, if you can get the buy-in from your players. I mean, like, if a player is like, I don't really have, like, the time to think about this, can you, you know, just come up with something that'll allow me to fit in, or I just want to play a guy that hits things with a sword, like, where should I be from? Fine, that's not a problem. But I think, like, some of the best games are the ones where you really work with the players to integrate them fully into the world, because you're going to get buy-in from them in the game. Because people who... when you're invested in your character, you're going to be more excited about the game. And people like having their character kind of be in the spotlight, you know, be the center of a specific session. And that is often going to happen when it's like, well, my character's from the dirty swamp, as you say. And if we go visit the swamp, or if someone else is from the swamp, or suddenly information about the swamp is super relevant, they'll be able to have that. And it can provide a lot of, like, interesting things. Like, you can have players that just know things that are out there in the world that they might or might not tell other people, or that just might not come up. Like, you know, there was a game where there was, like, an island of wizards, and they had a secret gnoll army. And that just didn't come up until we went and visited the wizards and were like, why are all these gnolls here?
Mm-hmm.
But so, one of the players was a wizard and just knew about that and just didn't bother to tell anyone.
So Pleasant Tomb has asked, when you start building a world on your own, where do you start? Do you base your decisions more on the player's choices when they build their characters, or do you more tend to decide on restrictions before they start building their characters? You know, I think that's kind of an important question, because, you know, if you're setting your story in, or you have plans to set it in the far north where it's cold and frigid, and all of your characters want to be tropical characters, mm-hmm. that might do you go through and say no, you need to build a one that fits this environment, or how do you do that, Brian?
I mean, I would say for the most part, since I don't tend to really. And then to do like a structured campaign beginning to end, most of my games are just like, well, let's just throw things together and go. I largely do use, you know, what the players come up with and kind of build adventure and story around that. And again, that's a part of my whole micro to macro evolution of building things and just seeing how far it goes before usually real life just gets in the way and games fall apart.
Rob, do you have some thoughts on this one?
I'll tend to go back and forth on this. It mostly depends on if I'm starting a game because, you know, I had some sort of idea that I wanted to go make a game with, or if I'm starting a game because my friends wouldn't stop pestering me until I started a game, so I've got nothing to work with except for what they gave me.
Okay. So there's another kind of question that Pleasant Doom asks that says, do you ever find yourself having to change the world drastically after the gameplay has started, and how do you handle that?
Constantly.
You find that constantly? Okay, can you give us an example?
So, had to do this one just recently with my local group. We started a Pathfinder 2 game, and I had started building it so as it's not in the generic Pathfinder setting.
Yeah.
And my fighter decided that he's joining the Pathfinder's Guild.
So, there had to be a Pathfinder's
Guild. So now all of a sudden I'm having to pull all of this large chunk of lore from the pre-existing thing and figure out where it fits into this world that I had been creating.
Yeah.
But it's a legitimate choice and it's kind of what he wants to be doing, so I'm working with it.
Well, okay, so what about, so Rodrigo and I have talked, and I think Rodrigo has talked a lot about his ideas of the Feywild. But when Orym came into being, Orym was created very much like, oh, here's what the Feywild is, and here's your typical Eladrin, your high elf type character. And that kind of conflicted with what you were doing with your world building, right, Rodrigo?
Yeah, to a certain degree. I wanted to take a much more weird version of the Feywild. Like, so when famously the genesis of Critical Hit is like Steven getting excited about Dungeons & Dragons 4th edition. Right. Like, we started this game because Steven started looking through the books and he was like, I want to do this. And so he'd like call me up and be like, I already made a character, before I like gave him any sort of guidelines, and he'd be like, I want my character to do this. And I'm like, okay, all right. So a lot of early Critical Hit is just kind of taking stuff that Steven was excited about and not telling him no. Famously, I mean, we're literally where we are right now because Steven saw, is like, oh, well, here are the gods that I have to choose from. I'm going to choose Corallon. And it's like, and that's why Corallon is even in this game. You know, and that's why that whole pantheon is even in this game. So, yeah, those player choices can have big impacts. But there's also times when you just say no. You know, it's like sometimes a player comes in and says, like, well, I want my player to be part of, like, the Singers Guild or whatever. Or the, God, what are they, like, the those bards that are, like, magical hero bards. Anyway. It doesn't matter. there are, and you already have maybe one, maybe more organizations that are occupying that space, and having that organization in the world would be problematic. You know, maybe you want to run a game in which the characters in which there's a lot of uncertainty about the world. So having this established guild that goes out there and finds stuff out is a problem. You don't want that. You want maybe your players to be the very first people to ever do that. Sometimes you just have to tell them no. And if they're like, well, it says in the book that I can, you just have to be like, yeah, but we're just not going to use that.
Yeah, and that kind of goes back to some of our player creation discussions, though. Rob, were you going to say something? No?
Not specifically.
Okay. All right. Well, then let's then talk about, have you guys ever changed your world's canon to be a surprise for your storytelling? For example, again, because I was going with a traditional Eldrin approach, when Rodrigo was like, oh no, when Eldrin die, they turn into flowers, right? Seemed very much a, oh, I didn't know that that was in this world. Have you guys ever done something like that, or had to, you know, keep something hidden or back from players in as you build your world, or had to radically change your world as to be kind of a surprise for players? Brad, have you ever had to do anything like that?
I guess I'm very macro in that everything is pretty much built by the time the players sit down at the table. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I know where the surprises are coming, but I have played with that trope. I mean, in the Shadow of the Demon Lord thing, there's, not to be too spoilery, but there's a point at which the characters go into that equivalent of the Feywild. And so I make a call out to Rodrigo's version of the Feywild, mm-hmm. and then completely subvert that so that everybody knows that, oh, this is really broken. So there are ways you can, I mean, there are ways at least that I would manipulate that, to create maybe a certain specific sense. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But not just for the sake of shock, because the whole point of the world building is kind of that you give your players a sense of where they are, right? But then if you keep subverting your own world building by changing the canon, then you're not creating a space for the players to be in. Or at least that's kind of how I feel about it, at least.
What about you, Sam?
Yeah, I mean, I've done, it's funny that you mentioned Coraline, like I've done something pretty dramatic where like there was a game where elves, like Coraline was a god, but in this he was the god of elves and death. And the reason why elves were so long lived was that like they were blessed by the god of death and they were super evil. So like, you know, kind of throwing some curveballs out there like that is a fun way to check player expectations, especially when in a game like D&D or Exalted, you know, when you get people who like have memorized the lore and the stats and think they know what's what, you know, having things like, oh no, you know, this demon is actually resistant or immune to these things that aren't what you think that they would be, can allow some surprise where you might not otherwise find it.
Okay, now I retract everything I said, and yeah, that's a great way to smack down the genre savvy character.
Now, yeah. Well, well, like I said, I do feel like there has to be a reason or purpose for any such changes. Yep. You can't just do it, as you said, like for the shock factor. I mean, that has to be helps if it's set up within the game before the pool. So it's kind of more of a realization moment if they haven't figured it out by then, and not just a what the heck.
Well, yeah, so D&D, then kind of tries to do that every once in a while. I remember in one of the monster manuals in like the 3.5 era, it's like, oh, here's a war troll. So it's like an even bigger troll that is like better at fighting. And this troll is actually vulnerable to like acid instead of fire. And I'm like looking through the description and I'm like, why? Why is that the case? Other than, you know, obviously your wizard's going to be like, ah, troll, like push up his glasses and like shoot it with a fireball. And then it's going to start regenerating anyway. And you want to surprise them, but It has to be motivated. It has to
absolutely
come from somewhere.
Otherwise, you wind up with like Daxamite Skriptonite. You know, that's like very silly. But like, you know, one of the things with when I mentioned with demons is it's, you know, one of the ideas I had was that like, you know, demons are inherently chaotic. And so like their resistances aren't just like about, you know, even though the book says fire, like you just their resistances are going to be unpredictable at any given time, which might be based on like where, you know, the ley lines of the abyss are at this moment, and like you can try to figure it out. But anything with world building should have logic behind it, because otherwise your players will be like, they'll know. It should feel real, because the bottom line when any fantasy world is you're just building a different world, and it should still have rules.
So do you think that people should follow the tropes of their genre and put all that stuff in? So if you're playing a Dungeons and Dragons game, you quote unquote should be following what is being set up in the game, like what you see in Eberron or Dark Sun or anything like that, because those are the things that people are familiar with. And so if you're going to say, well, we're going to be playing a traditional Dungeons and Dragons game, and then all of a sudden a spaceship lands in the middle of the playing field, they're going to be like, well, that's not how Dungeons and Dragons works, or that's not how this world of Dungeons and Dragons works.
Well, there's a few adventure modules that would say that's wrong.
Yeah,
like Blue Mountain.
Yeah, but, super true.
It is important to. It's like you don't want to. It's like you can trick your players, but you don't want to lie to your players, right? And by that, I don't mean you don't want to tell them lies, because I lie to my players all the time. But it's in the spirit of giving them a surprise within the context of the game. So that's the important part.
You don't
want to do it maliciously. You don't want to do it for no reason. If I feel that with this group right here, if we were running a game and Steven was like, well, this is just going to be a very traditional, I'm not very experienced, very traditional Dungeons and Dragons game, and then he plopped a UFO in the middle of like the first fight, then I feel like we'd all be into it. I'd be like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh, sure, Steven, sure.
Yeah, Steven like kind of hoodwinked us, quote unquote, but this is fun. We weren't expecting this. Let's go. There are going to be groups that don't like that. Mm-hmm. And you just kind of have to know your group.
So yeah, you know, you talked about not lying to players, Rodrigo. I don't lie to my players, but my NPCs lie to my players all the time.
Sure.
And that's a really like, and it's because my NPCs are motivated to do that, right? And it occurs to me that one of the things in world building is you have to have motivated NPCs, right? NPCs who are doing certain things for certain reasons,
and who are motivated to not always help. Like even helpful NPCs have to have their own stuff going on.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And it's helpful, or it's interesting to reveal those motives like later on in the story. But classically on the podcast games, that my players always seem to buy into whatever the NPCs tell them, which I find amusing.
So,
I'll get
so, so just, yeah,
well, that's
so
what
just,
you're dealing with idiots too, Brad.
So just real quick, that in and of itself is a genre expectation.
Yeah.
We like when Superman goes up to Lex Luthor, Lex Luthor just tells him his plan and like expects that Superman's not going to be able to stop him. Right. It's like bad guys tell good guys exactly what they're doing all the time, because Not every story has an investigation aspect to it. Sometimes like the writer doesn't want to mess with like having the heroes discover what's happening. The wizard's like, no, I'm using this orb to take over the world. And everyone's like, oh, okay. So if you find that in your game, your players are very gullible, you have to, and you don't want them to be, you have to kick them in the shins early. Just very early, you have to have somebody lie to them and have it go horribly, and then they'll be distrustful of everybody else. Simultaneously, if you're the sort of person that just wants to be able to freely deliver information through NPCs to your players at all times, don't do that. Because if you're like, oh, I know, I'll have like this very first innkeeper lie to them, your players will never trust another one of your NPCs again and will like stab like the secret princess that was supposed to help them and whatever, like immediately. Like they won't even talk to her.
Yeah,
so you have to manage that very carefully at the onset of your game.
It's maybe it is the peculiarities of the people I play with major spoilers, but yeah, like even in that Call of Cthulhu game.
Yes, you know, we're idiots, Brad. I get it.
No, it's probably because a lot of them come from Critical Hit, and in Critical Hit, the NPCs usually don't lie to the players.
Yeah.
NPCs and bad NPCs don't, they hide stuff. And a lot of the time they'll be hiding stuff and I'll tell the players, well, this person's hiding something, but they don't lie because in like thematically, there's just so much information in this world that I'm like, I can't afford the players to question whether this island is 20 leagues away or 50 leagues away. Like that's, I can't I can't have them question that. So the implicit thing is all the NPCs are telling you the truth, but they're still trying to manipulate you to get you to do what they want you to do.
Yeah, like in that Call of Cthulhu game, this is one of the mechanics of the game. Well, I guess it's not a mechanic, but it's a trope of the game. NPCs either have no idea what's going on as far mm-hmm. as the great conspiracy to do something horrible that's happening in the game. Either an NPC has no idea what's going on, or they're a part of the conspiracy and they're going to completely mislead the players. And I tried to, one of the things that happened really early on was the players are driving around in a car and they're trying to find some information about like Rob's uncle. And so they ask this guy, hey, where should we go looking for this kind of person? He says, well, you should go over here and look. And so they go over there and look, and this is a complete dead end. And I thought, wow, I was really congratulating myself for the way I laid that in there, that, okay, now they know that people are generally stupid and they'll tell you stupid things. And it had no effect on anything whatsoever. And it was really just depressing. Yeah.
As Steven has said a couple of times, remember when you're playing with idiots.
So I'm curious, you guys, Brian, you were talking about a Ken and Robin episode.
Yeah,
recently, where they're talking about some of these tropes and expectations.
Yeah, and they had mentioned this game system, Earthdawn.
I've not heard of that.
No, it's a fairly older one. Like, I think it first came out in the 90s, but it's apparently set within the same timeline as Shadowrun, and that's the only thing I really had ever known it as. So, basically a prequel to Shadowrun. So I just assumed it was Shadowrun without Cyberpunk, and I was like, I already got plenty of other fantasy games. Why do I need this? But apparently what this game does that's fairly interesting is it does really play with all the tropes and expectations of D&D and makes them exist within the world for a reason, tries to make them all like consistent and coherent with the world and build the world around those expectations and make a lot of that mechanical situations like actual character knowledge within the world. Like apparently people actually know like what level, or I guess they call it circle in this game, the heroes
they
are.
They can just tell.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's a thing that, somehow, they can kind of gauge like what people are capable of. I've only just started cracking into this big old tome with a classic edition player's handbook, so it's player's compendium actually. So I haven't really gotten too far into how this is actually executed, but I just thought that was a really neat idea, just to like building upon the tropes of D&D and building the world on that,
mm-hmm.
like having the dungeons in the world exist because basically there's this big old eldritch monster apocalypse, and so everyone went underground to hide from them.
Nice.
And so now that people are coming back to the surface, they're going to down into these other communities that didn't make it and getting all the old treasures and whatnot that's there and running into those horde monsters.
Cool. Brad, you slipped me a note beforehand. It says linear or sandbox. What does that mean?
Actually, I didn't put that in there, but I.
Oh, okay.
I tagged that as something I was interested in. Well, I mean, so the two games I did for Major Spoilers, the Call of Cthulhu game is totally sandbox, and the Shadow of the Demon Lord game is totally linear. I mean, I played on both sides of that spectrum really, really hard because I like both sides of those. But the only way I felt like I could get away with the totally linear Shadow of the Demon Lord game is it's structured so it's like 11 adventures and you're out.
I was going to say, how much was that influenced by the actual mechanics where, you did have the level structure and that many
levels? I had the plot. I mean, the plot was pretty well ironed out, and there was no room for anybody to, well, there was a little, like, you could have done the adventures in different orders, right? Mm-hmm, and so it was open to, like, we could do, adventures 5, 6, and 7 or something like that in a different order.
Call of Cthulhu, there really isn't an expectation of character growth and advancement so much as there is in other games.
The expectation you're all going to die. What about the rest of you? Sam, do you like doing a linear world or letting everybody just kind of build it as they go in a sandbox?
So my problem with sandboxes is sometimes you just don't know where to go. I like relatively linear because or at least like a almost MMO-esque quest hub model where it's like you've got a lot of things that you know you can do, as opposed to a full sandbox where it's like you're not really sure where you're supposed to interact, and you can wind up like, well, we're gonna go to this place because it sounds interesting, and it like turns out that there's nothing there. Like, there should always be something there for the players to interact with, as opposed to it's like, oh, somehow this place has just either no problems that you can deal with, or like problems that are so amazingly big that you're not prepared to deal with them yet. So having a path just, I think, helps, unless you have like players that are really, really motivated to like make their own fun wherever they go, just gives structure to the game.
Yeah, I kind of like when we played Modern City, I really like that we spent an episode just building the world as a group. So we kind of all knew what to expect and then let the game master go in and play, let us play in that world and throw problems at us in that world. And then when we did the 6-issue mini that's currently up there on patreon.com/majorspoilers, those rules kind of, we didn't have to go back and rebuild a whole other world, even though it doesn't take place in Modern City. We trust that the world has been built up enough to where now the GM can go and mess around with things. So I kind of like that, how we work together to build that world. But, you know, so here's the thing.
Yeah, but so a sandbox doesn't necessarily mean a cooperative game.
No.
Linear versus sandbox is more of a structural thing than world-building thing. You can play a linear game in the world of the Void Saga, and you can play a sandbox game in the world of the Void Saga.
Well, and then, so that does, you know, I'm just saying that the how we built it together seems like a hybrid of both a little bit. But it does go into this question that Pleasant Doom has asked. It says, how do you approach building onto a world that you've inherited from another GM? Now, this can come from a number of different ways. Your player, your party has all said, hey, we like playing in this world. Okay, now it's Pleasant Doom's time to go, and we all want to continue the adventure in this same world. How do you build upon that? Or, you know, a lot of people don't like extensive world building, and they're more than happy to play pull the Eberron Player's Guide off the shelf, or the Penny Arcade World, or the Critical Role World book off the shelf, and want to tell stories in there. So, how do you approach building onto a world that you've inherited from a GM or from a player's guide? Who has some ideas on that, Rob?
So it kind of depends on what the players are looking for. Why are you inheriting this world? Is it because everybody really likes the themes of this world? Everybody really likes, you know, NPCs that have been showing up, or people want to maybe accidentally run into their former PCs? You're going to have to figure out why this world is the one that you, either as a DM or your group, wants to play there. So you can always, you can start with, you know, just take what you've already been given and figure out what any given story hook that was left over might have been, mm-hmm. or you can find something brand new that you actually bring to the world yourself. It mostly is a matter of theming, again, where whose decision was it to redo this world?
Okay. All right. Before we run out of time, I want to jump into some questions. Here's one that says, I'm a new DM to 4th edition. I'm about to start a mini campaign at 8th level for my D&D group. The setting I've created is a new primal world, and I'm worried because I don't want there to be as large a presence of magic items as 4th edition seems to expect. At the same time, I don't want my players to die in combat due to a lack of magic items, because I will be building my encounters from the Dungeon Master and the Monster Manual handbooks. I'm trying to limit the presence of magic items to one per character, so my question is, should I try to compensate for lack of magic items by giving them items of a higher level, or do you have a general suggestion? And this is, I brought this question in because that does go into this idea of world building. How much of these things do you want to be in there? And right. If you're working with a system like Dungeons and Dragons that say, here's what these powers are and here's what things do, is that something that would potentially hinder and harm your players?
Magic items are just like such a perfect example of themes, right? It's like in most Dungeons and Dragons game, there's just like magic swords and shields and axes and armor just like raining from the sky at all times, right? You just like find so much. You like kill one dragon and it outfits your whole party, and then you kill the next dragon and you're like, well, I guess we have to sell all of our loot from before to wear this new loot, right? So if you don't want that, in 4th edition, there are these rules called inherent bonuses, and they're in the Dungeon Master's Guide too. And we actually use those rules for Critical Hit for this last chapter of the Void Saga. And I've actually used those rules before for kind of like your alternate characters, like, Longshanks or Zanam or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
All of those characters were working under inherent bonuses. Now the entire party is working under inherent bonuses. And they basically give you they just give you the proper bonus at a proper level of a magic item of that level. And they basically also do away with all of the, a party's supposed to get like 4 magic items and gold equal to like 2 magic items of a particular level. So it does away with like 3 of those magic items. You just get the biggest magic item and then some gold slash residuum or magic components. And then that's kind of what it does. But it does bring an additional issue, which is like you have to change things about the world when magic items aren't that big a deal. In the Void Saga, I never wanted magic items to be a big deal. Or rather, I did want magic items to be a big deal. I wanted each individual magic item to be something, which is why the party tends to come about them in such unusual ways. And you don't see, you know, the captain of the Royal Guard having a magic sword. That's just not something that happens. It's not until like recently that, everybody's at epic level where it's like, yeah, it makes sense for like these, like a bunch of guys to have magic weapons. Like that does start to make sense at like higher, crazier situations. But, you know, magic items, how magic works, all this other stuff, that's stuff that you have to think about. And if you want to change it, you have to either make it abundantly clear that you're changing it or run it by the players, or like me, start with players that weren't very familiar with fourth edition and just kind of tell them that that's how it is and nuts to your Asmar.
Well, so that does, Colin does ask this question. He goes, do you guys have any tips for beginners when it comes to world building? How deep do you want to go when you're developing your game?
I would say my biggest tip is at first only go as deep as you want. Like, don't force yourself to go much farther than you want to go. Figure out how much time you have to spend on your game and figure out how exciting it is to create for your game and just do that. And then if that turns out to be very little, definitely get some help from your players. Have them help you create stuff. If that turns out to be a lot, you can dial that down and just give the players information about, you know, I was like, oh, it's going to be set here and it's going to be like this. So pick a region that I've already given you and we'll go from there kind of stuff. You know, definitely tailor it to what is enjoyable to you. Try to make it as much or as little of a chore as possible.
Rob, do you have some suggestions?
Rodrigo's hit it perfectly. Like, do what's going to make you comfortable. Don't do anything more than you need to. Don't do anything more than you can do anything more than you need to. Don't do anything more than you want to.
So you don't have to build every square block of a city in your world. You can just build the front sets that they're walking down. You don't have to go down any further if you don't want to go down. Now if they suddenly veer off and go into the tavern, well, suddenly you've got to build a tavern for them to walk into. Sure. Yeah.
And don't let world building keep you from starting.
Yeah, there's also that.
Yeah, there's a good question.
Perfect is the enemy of the good.
Do you ever find yourself building a game world before there's even a game to go with it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, sure. Hundreds of them.
Hundreds of them?
Yeah, I've got so many Google Docs that are anywhere from like crocodile world ? to like almost fully fleshed out settings.
Nice. Let's see. Are there any resources for world building out there for GMs to use that you recommend? I was looking, I had a book a couple of years ago, and I've recommended it, I believe, on the Critical Hit podcast itself. I went back. I can't find it anywhere in my library, but it really, do you remember the book that I'm talking about?
Yeah, I think you've mentioned Kobold Guide to World Building.
That's it.
I put it in my drive-through RPG wish list, but I've not picked it up yet. So
yeah, it looks... There's
hint, you guys.
There are multiple different authors that are all talking about different approaches to world building. Some of them from the micro level, some of them from the macro level. Some of them just are like, don't worry about any of that. Just do it. But here are some things. Let me just throw out some words for you guys who are listening that might help you build your world. Think about
What's the calendar of your world like? What are big holidays? Or what's the history of a land that you're working on? Are there any legends and myths? Are there slangs or expressions? Certainly when we went to the southern continent, that was filled with slang and expressions. Are there superstitions? Are there traditions? Are there any guilds in this world? What about police? What about armies? What about smugglers? What about customs? How far are you going to go into bureaucracy? Who are the quote-unquote good guys and who are the quote-unquote bad guys? Climate, races. Are there any major world events that have happened? What are the plants and animals like in this world? Those are some things that you can write down and start building on it. I use a program called Scrivener, and I have found a add-on to this in the book writing section that walks you through, and I guess I don't have it here in front of me, but it's got a whole thing on world building, and it asks you all of these questions, and ideally it's so you can help figure out your book, but these kinds of things help trigger, oh, okay, what are the politics in this world? Who are the different factions and how do they see each other? Even though it may never come up in the story that you're telling, having some kind of perspective on that might help. So these kind of keywords might help you out as well. And I think those are all of the questions that we have this week or this month for this installment of the Game Masters Roundtable, the GM Roundtable. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining us tonight. We have a record number of people hanging out in the chat room this month, and we want you to come in and hang out with us next time. All you need to do is link your Patreon account, patreon.com/majorspoilers. Anyone at the silver level and higher has access to the GM Roundtable. You just link your Patreon account to the Discord, and then you will have access to all these secret channels that you get to come and hang out in, including the GM Roundtable, where you can listen to us record the show, ask your questions live, and then chat with other awesome fans of the show. So there we go. That wraps it up. Thank you so much, everyone, for your time. And until next time, get out there and build a magnificent world.
This podcast is copyright 2019 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.